Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'll be speaking with fellow practitioner Howard Atkins, who has a vast experience working in leadership and OD with senior leaders and teams in the public, private and third sectors. He's worked around the world for over 25 years, and he's such a thoughtful and insightful practitioner, driven by a desire to help organisations become more successful and at the same time becoming happier and more rewarding places to work. I was delighted to speak with Howard and offer our wider community the opportunity to explore with him what work in team is. In this episode, Howard opens up his practice to share the type of work with teams he's involved with and how his work is changing as we move to virtual and blended working. We hear Howard share what he means by team health and how this relates to work at the team level in supporting the effectiveness and enjoyment of a team and how this shows up in relationships, decisions, discussions, as well as outcomes. He cautions us to be aware of our biases and assumptions as practitioners and as team members, particularly when we're offered that initial presenting issue. Really trying to understand what is it that we're here to do. We examine the criticality of trust and psychological safety in doing this work as facilitators and touch in on the differing roles and risks that our internal facilitator colleagues deal with. Howard shares with us his approach to one of the early phases in work with teams, the inquiry phase, and the role it plays in building trust and positioning ownership for the work with the team. Howard works from an appreciative stance to build on and support the potential of a team, embracing the differences. We unpack the various aspects of our practice and explore the various hats that the facilitator can play in this work. We touch on the importance of individual team member development as part of a wider team development process. And we explore what's changed when this work has moved to the virtual space and the outlook for work in a more hybrid world, really trying to challenge ourselves as practitioners to raise our game in challenging assumptions and also getting really clear on what works best, where, how and why. We even explore why turning cameras off as an intervention can be a meaningful exploration for a team. And of course, we keep this pragmatic and explore how this work is judged through understanding the measures that Howard's clients use. I knew this was a conversation I was going to love, as Howard brings such depth of practice and humanity to his work, whilst also giving us a real sense of what the work is. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Perhaps as you listen to the episode, you can ask yourself, what's your role in this work, whether as facilitator, team lead, or perhaps HR? And what's the framework for this process? How will you ensure team ownership of the focus and priorities? Hi, Howard. Wonderful to have you here with us on Team Time Table Talks. I wonder, just to get us started, if you could give us an introduction to who you are, the type of work you do with teams.
Well, hi, Debbie. Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be discussing with you this afternoon. I'm an organisation and leadership development consultant. So I've been working in this field for over 25 years now. And I work across a whole range of industries and organizations. I've been lucky enough to work all across the world. And working with individuals, with teams, and with wider organization groups. But a core focus of my work really is helping teams become more effective and more enjoyable places to work.
Fabulous. I'm sure we'll come back to this, but I think there's so much discussion around what an effective team is.
Yes.
And only just, you know, starting to have discussion around what an enjoyable team experience is. So let's pick up on those two.
I realize they're high bars as well, aren't they? Both enjoyable and effective. Yes,
they are. And yeah, to have them both to come together, that is the pinnacle, isn't it? Of, you know, a team that people actually want to be a part of. So, I mean, I'm delighted to have you join us and to share your experience with our listeners. You know, this series is about lifting the lid on work at the team level, because in my experience, you know, as a practitioner in this space, the work is often sensitive and therefore hidden, and yet it's complex. And so for me, there's something about actually, can we rise up the profile a little bit of what we mean by this work, particularly at a time when, you know, teams have had a tough time this past, you know, year, 15 months. I wonder what you have noticed from your work with teams in terms of the environment and the experience over this last period.
I mean, I think it's been the most extraordinary year, over a year now, for all of us all around the world, and teams are no exception to that. I think it's really hard to generalize. So my experience of teams over this last period has been so diverse. I think it's really hard to know exactly what a particular team or individual has been experiencing. So I suppose one thing I would hold on to very tightly is, don't make any assumptions about how a team or an individual member of a team has been experiencing the last year.
Mm.
So I've been working with teams where some members have been furloughed, some members have been kept employed, some have been physically located in an office space while others have been working from home. And each person's experience is unique, and each person's response to that is unique. I think for some people, it's been an enormous time of stress, fear, and anxiety. So there's the fear of the organizational task, if you like. What are we here to do, and are we going to survive as an organization? Obviously, I've been working a lot in the National Health Service in the UK, where the task is there right in front of you every day. But how are we going to do this, and how are we going to organize ourselves, and are we going to put ourselves at huge personal risk, are all things that have been uppermost in people's minds. So it's been a time of stress and difficulty and anxiety. And at the same time, I've heard stories of people saying, well, actually, we've finally been able to achieve something we've been trying to do for the last 3 or 4 years. So because, in a sense, everything's been thrown up into the air, change projects, processes, relationships, collaborations that have been that organizations and teams have been struggling with over the last few years have suddenly become possible.
Mm.
And everything suddenly frees up. So I've had people say to me, team leaders say to me, I've had the time of my professional life over the last year, despite everything that's going on.
Mm.
And for others, it's been hugely difficult and stressful. So don't make assumptions. Everybody's experience is unique.
That's such good advice and healthy reminder, you know, that we don't know where we're starting from, and that it really is the start is understanding where we're starting from.
Indeed, yeah.
You were a co-author of what I thought was a fascinating report into leaders in the public sector, as you say, in NHS during the first lockdown. I guess through that research, uncovered some aspects that seemed to have commonality that related to leaders and to teams. And I think it speaks to one of the things that you've mentioned, you know, there's been such great disparity in how we've experienced it.
Mm.
And then when you bring it into the team environment, where those individual experiences show up, but they do it against the background of the strength of where the team was starting from. And so in one of your sections, you talk about cohesive versus splintered teams, and you know how our individual experiences show up, you know, given the background of what position our team started in. I wonder if you can speak to what do you mean by a cohesive or a splintered team?
I think what you're alluding to, and we discussed in the report, is in a sense team cultures, if you like, that were already what I would term healthy, tended to be the ones that survived better through a very tough time and through the first wave of COVID and lockdown in the UK. What we mean by healthy, and what we discovered through the research, was just a few simple things. As a team, are we able to talk about what I would call the truth of the matter? So are we able to be honest with each other about what is really going on? And that's really going on about the, in terms of the task that's in front of us, you know, the reality of the situation, however difficult and challenging. Can we be honest about that with each other? And often I think particularly team leaders shy away from that through trying to protect the team from the truth. And actually an ability to acknowledge the truth, however difficult, openly within the team, is something which helps team. So the cohesive teams were those ones that could be able to do that. The other truth that's important to be able to talk about is individuals' experiences. So is it okay for someone to come into a team and say, do you know, I'm really struggling today. I'm telling you how I am. Can someone support me here? Even more challenging for the leader, the formal leader of a team, to do that. Say, do you know, I'm okay, but today I'm struggling a bit. I'm going to need some support with this. And for it to be okay to be vulnerable in that sort of way. Or for a member of the team to come in and say, I don't know. I don't know what is going on. I don't know what we're going to be doing next week. All I do know is this is our task today. This is our purpose. And therefore, this is what we're going to do for the next 24 hours. I mean, it really gets down to that level of...
Well, one of the things that I think, and I'm sure we're going to come on to in terms of how we evaluate or measure the work that we do in this space, is how well the team recognize and can speak to their experience of the team and being part of the team. So not just the individual's experience, but what it feels like being part of this team and kind of noticing our own dynamics and patterns and preferences. And for me, that's one of the kind of success criteria, is whether that in some ways, that capacity builds within the team itself to notice. So when you talk about team health, that for me is one of the signs that I would be looking for, is how well able are they to identify and locate their shared experience as well as their unique experience.
And it can feel like a very brave conversation, can't it? So for me, it's a sign of team strength or team maturity is the ability for any member of the team to say, hang on a minute, can we just pay attention to what is going on right here, right now, for us as a team? And I think that's a really tricky thing to do. It's tricky for a number of reasons. One, I think you're putting yourself on the line a bit, aren't you? You're sort of saying, hang on a minute, can we pause and pay attention to what's going on? Really tough when the task is so immediate. So in the health service world particularly, you've got immediate life and death decisions to be made. And you're the one who's going to say, hang on a minute, let's talk about how we are doing as a team.
Yeah.
Might be just the right thing to do, but it's quite a brave intervention, if you like. So there's that bravery, and there's also, I think, the skill and the ability and the awareness to do that. And it's not something that comes overnight. I think quite a bit of my work with teams is helping them very gently become what I would call more process aware, more aware of their own process in terms of how they do things, more aware of each individual's contribution and feelings within the team, and skills around the ability to actually discuss it and talk about it without it becoming over personal or people fearing doing it. That doesn't come overnight. I mean, I think that is part of an evolution of team and teamwork.
And so I think we're straying into some of what the work is. And I wonder, as we sort of take those steps forward, I have a model that I use that is, you know, if we imagine a triangle and its top peak, when we're relating or talking of teams, we have the relationships and well-being of that team and the relationships within that team. And then at one of the other corners is sort of the collective thinking and being, if you like, of the team. And at the third point is the purpose, performance, kind of outputs, deliverables.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about work in or at the team level, it's often located somewhere for me in there, however it may show up or however it may, originate. But I wonder for you, how would you describe what work at the team level is to help our listeners orient?
Yeah. I love your model. It in a way it covers it. So if we have sort of relationships, discussion and decision making, action and outcome, that I've sort of reworded your three areas there, but that's how I see it, and all are important and all are interdependent. And I suppose if I'm honest, because of my background is I have a master's in organization development, but I did a lot of human behavior and psychology. That's kind of my real interest. So I'm aware I will always bring in the relationships and well-being part. And if I'm honest, as a practitioner, I need to be aware of that because the issue or the problem to be solved is not always there. It might be around collective thinking and being. It might be around decision making. It may be links to performance. So relationships will always be important, but I think as a consultant and practitioner, it's really important to be aware of our own bias and also the bias of our clients, who will in a sense offer us the presenting problem. So for example, I've been working with an organization over the last year, quite a small organization, and I've been working with the senior leadership team. And the presenting issue to me was presented very much as a relationship issue. And it was this sort of classic thing about splits within the team and silos and some individuals feeling marginalized. How can we make that a happier, more harmonious, more effective place to work? Actually, through conversations and working with the team, I think it is about that, but there's also big questions around purpose and strategy, which are not talked about by the whole team. They're talked about by a subset of the team. And there's questions about how decisions are made. So some very practical things around decision-making, which lead to budget allocation and resource allocation, which then feed into the relationship issues. So they're all connected, but it's where do we start? Actually,
So the mantra often in our kind of helping roles are you start where the client is, isn't it? And in some ways, it's the acknowledging where the start is, whilst also having the space and the trust to explore more broadly, because these things are so interconnected, as you say. And I can think of work where I've been brought in and maybe it's got a strategic focus, but actually it's kind of the opposite of to your one, where actually there was something fundamental in the relationships that needed some attention and intention. But it tends to show up, whether it's strategy, purpose, performance, decision making, it's rooted in the quality of the relationships and the quality of the collective thinking and our ability to voice or articulate, whichever way we enter or access it.
I think it's interesting. I think that the example you've given is far more common, where the presenting issue is a sort of strategic or performance thing. And then our work maybe is to, yes, address that, but also open up the possibility of working around relationships. So I think the example I gave is slightly unusual to come in around that way.
Well, and I would agree, because in some ways often teams, you know, if I can be very candid, they don't necessarily want to put the money into the inquiry around the relationships and the time, but it's far clearer if the output is a deliverable that, you know, we'll get at the end of this X product, as opposed to we'll actually be a more dynamic, connected, compassionate team.
And we know that is potentially more difficult to measure and justify for someone who's spending money with us. So absolutely, I can understand that. You mentioned another word as you were talking, which was trust, which was gaining the trust to work on the real, what we would see as the real issues.
Yeah.
And I think what I've learned is that in some instances takes time and it takes sustained effort. So I'm becoming more relaxed at starting where the client is and taking time to slowly open that up and explore other areas and not worry so much about that, actually. I'm aware of different organization cultures and different national cultures, trust develops in different ways and sort of just, I suppose I've become more relaxed and go with the flow about that, really.
I had a fascinating conversation with Sarah Rosentuller, and her focus is all about purpose. But we were talking about our role as facilitators and how in many ways we adapt our size and possibly shape to shrink or expand to what's needed. You know, I often say it as we're the vehicle through which teams experience themselves. And so there's something about, so trust being the individual relationship, but psychological safety being the collective, property across the collective group. And for me, I speak about this on the very first episode, where I talk about how we set up well and the importance for me that we spend actually a good amount of time understanding what setting up well means, in terms of starting that container that allows you the space to, you know, really explore and find where is the work here, but to do it with the team. Not to do it as an independent, you know, navigator. I wonder as you would imagine starting work with a team, and you say you're more relaxed now in that process. What are those early stages for you as you set up well to work with a team?
I mean, for me, they will always begin with conversations. Now, it's been interesting over the last year because those conversations have normally been on via some virtual app or telephone even. I suppose it's in a sense the traditional skill of good inquiry. So setting up a series of inquiry conversations with key people who are connected to the team. So often the initial conversation might be with the chief exec or the leader of a team, or with some HR representative or an organization development representative of that team who may themselves be a member or may not. I suppose my approach will always be to cast the net as broadly as possible. So if possible, talk to everybody. I have a preference for talking to everybody individually first. There's something about the collective trust, which to me seems to come from a deep individual trust first. So I personally find it much easier to work with a team if I've had quite an in-depth connection with each of them as individuals prior to us meeting as a group. Now I have colleagues who operate very differently, but that certainly enables me to be at my best. And in terms of that inquiry, I'm pretty clear the inquiry conversations are not about me gathering data and as some sort of diagnosis and then feeding it back to the group.
Mm.
Those inquiry conversations are the first step of the work with the team, and they are to provoke reflection, thoughts, provocation, and feelings of support to each of the people I'm talking to, in order that they begin to think about, well, what is my view of the team and what is my part in that? And what might I like to take responsibility for? So that by the time I then actually work at what I would call the sort of collective team level with everybody present, they already know what all the issues are because they've done, they've already talked about it all and they've surfaced it. And then I loved your phrase about our role as facilitators in terms of, in a sense, holding the mirror up to the team, them discovering who they are. Our role then becomes, in a sense, quite straightforward. It's very skilled, but quite straightforward, is allowing them to continue having those conversations with each other that they've begun, and begin sharing those reflections with each other that they might have been doing as a result of a conversation they've had with us.
So if we say that the early stages are setting up well, and part of that is an inquiry process, and for you, you do one-to-ones and then bring that into the collective, what would, and I don't know if we can say a typical, but I want to, what would be sort of a frame for this kind of work? What does it look like in terms of who meets, what's the nature, how often, like what can we kind of just open the curtain a little bit to what that looks like?
I think it's probably best if I just give you some examples, because there is, what I've learned is there are limitations and constraints and possibilities that are so different in different organizations. So a typical process might be, say you have a team of 10 people, I would have a series of individual conversations with each of them, and then we would gather together in some way. Now, currently, that gathering together is virtually, and I feel I've learned a lot as a facilitator over the last year. Maybe we'll touch on that later about how to do that well. But there's some gathering together, which may be a half day, and that gathering together is in a sense to share where we've got to. So I would typically present back some of my hunches, some provocation, the themes I've heard, but it's only to provoke them then to share what they've been. So it's a sort of a first take to encourage conversation amongst the team around those themes. And then in that first session to collectively decide, so what is the work then? So if we've heard all of these themes, we can't do everything. What is the most valuable thing for us to spend our time on? What are the most important things for us to spend our time on? So that might be the first session. If I'm fortunate enough to have an ongoing, often it's ongoing budget, to be honest, as an external consultant, then it might be, well, okay, we're going to meet every 3 weeks for half a day for four sessions or something like that. And in between, we will agree experiments. So this idea of, well, what are we going to pay attention to and experiment with as a team in the intervening time? And then we meet and review what's been going on, work out the themes. I may add in some models, ideas, provocation, and we just see how it's going over a period of time. That to me is much more sustainable than the kind of one hit team building day, which I think, used to be dragging people on across mountains and all of that for 4 days and then launching them back into the organization and never seeing people again. I'm not sure that's a sustainable model of team development. There have been other teams I've worked with where I've been able to see them far less often, where it's involved a lot of physical travel in the past. Where I might spend 3 days with a team. And that's a chance to have some really in-depth conversations. And within that, I would always ask them to do some business as usual. And for me, just to sit and be present and observe. And if you like, hold the mirror up to what I see going on. So they're interspersing, if you like, team development and learning activity with everyday work.
Mm.
Other work I've done, just a different example would be where I simply join a team for their monthly meetings on an ongoing basis, and I would facilitate a making sense feedback review session at the end of each session. So really that becomes very closely aligned to their ongoing schedule of work, if you like.
And as you reflect on those different forms of team development, what's your role in them? And I've deliberately not given you a label, you know, but it'd be interesting to, you know, what do you call yourself, and what is the role, and does it change based on those different formats that you've talked about?
It's great. I'm smiling. I know people won't be able to see me smiling. A client said to me a couple of years ago, after I'd worked with them and their team some time, "Oh, Howard's one of us now." And I remember being horrified. In a way, it was lovely, because what it was meant as a huge appreciation that I was completely trusted, completely part of them, and was able to join their social activities. And part of me was deeply concerned about, have I lost my role and my boundary here? And I think it's that fine line between being a part of the team and a part from the team. So I see fundamentally my role, I think, is to help the team be the best version of themselves that they can be. Okay, so that's the sort of meta purpose. And to make it, them, as we said right at the beginning, the most enjoyable and most productive experience. So that's my main sort of meta role. Within that, I see myself sometimes doing a lot of asking of questions, and asking of questions not so they answer to me, but so they talk to each other. So I feel like a convener of conversations. I see myself as someone who points out what isn't being said. So I might be the one who says, it's interesting, I've been listening to you talk for the last 2 hours and no one's mentioned the word customer or client. What's going on? So I might make more classic process interventions, which is, it seems to me, you know, two or three people are sharing a lot here and others are silent. I'm wondering what's going on. So those sort of classic process interventions. I think increasingly I'm provocative. I didn't used to be. I think I've both grown in confidence in doing that, but also the feedback from clients that being provoked and being asked difficult questions and challenging questions is what they really value. And I, as an external eye, it's easier for me to do that than for other people. It's not career limiting for me in the way it is for some internal people to be provoking and to ask provoking questions, be provocative. So I find myself doing that. I find myself having lots of, within a team session, one-on-one supportive chats. Now, when we were, if you're physically face-to-face, that might be over coffee, you know, so really helping people either make sense or giving them some genuine support. So mini coaching, I think, is a role I take on. And I offer models, ideas, and frameworks that I feel will be helpful straight away. So I will never offer sort of theory for the sake of it, but there are ideas and models that I find very helpful and teams seem to find helpful. So I'm a bit of a teacher occasionally. And very occasionally I will sit and say nothing and just be there. And I used to worry about that because I used to think, oh, I'm not earning my money here. And what will they be thinking of me? And of course they're not thinking that at all. They're ignoring me. The power of just being present and maybe offering some very light reflections and feedback at the end is a role I think is really valuable. I'm also aware that just by being there as an external, it has an impact. And this is both positive and negative. I'm aware some people are on their best behavior because I'm there, and that's not helpful.
Mm.
And part of the building of trust is that people relax and stop trying to impress or be on their best behavior.
Which is in the spirit, I'm sure that the "you've become one of us" was offered.
Yes.
But so that's really helpful to get a sense of all the different hats that you can wear in this work. I wonder if I could pick up on a few aspects, and the ones that are sort of most coming to mind at the moment are around, so there's whatever format. I'm curious what your judgment and experience is in the relationship between what happens at the collective and what happens with the individual, and the relationship through particularly a multi intervention process. And part of the reason is I was part of this series speaking to Catherine Green, who's an HRD, and one of her reflections, you know, from that role was that her belief is that this work is more powerful if it's kind of got a focus at the team and then out again, so the individuals are doing some work in service of the team, but then they come back up at the team level. And maybe that was part of what might be covered in your between experiment phase. But I wonder if you could just reflect or share your reflections on, we talk about team development, but it does also often involve individual development. And what's your perspective on that relationship?
Absolutely. I think it's a key relationship. So I completely agree with is Catherine, was it?
Catherine, yeah.
Catherine, yes. Absolutely. And I'm wondering if it's possible to do team development without touching the individual. And I don't think it is. For the reason that we bring ourselves to a team setting and we bring slightly different versions of ourselves. So I know that I'm slightly different in one group than I am in another group, than I am in another group. And that's true for all of us. We are social beings. We are socially constructed. So even though I'm recognisably Howard, I behave different in different teams. And that's exactly the pattern of all of us. We all behave, I believe, ever so slightly differently in different settings, in different teams. So paying attention to who am I in this team right now is a really important part of team development. And if we're to do that, then giving individuals the tools and the support to explore more about who am I and how do I tick and what are my preferences and how do I learn, paying attention to that is really, really important. So I see them in a sense coming alongside each other, and I think in my work I will always put a joint emphasis on developing individuals and developing the team, and I assume that one supports the other.
Can I ask a crunchy question? I think there's certainly been some experiences where either the contracting person, HR, or as you say, OD, possibly the CEO, has a clear view as to what the issue is, what needs to happen, etc. And once you're in inquiry with the team, there are varying levels of appetite to work either at the team level or to recognise the relationship between my development and what happens at the team. And so I guess the crunchiness is, what if everybody's not up for it? And again, it's what I'd like to do as part of this series is help people recognize where there are tips. It's those signals that I think through practice we learn to watch and listen and frankly just sense there's something else going on here. And for me, one of them is if people if they don't feel safe enough to to focus on their individual development as part of a team process, then that's actually a really important bit of information that shouldn't be ignored. But I just wonder, so the crunchy question is, how do you work with individuals in a team that don't want to step into the development for themselves?
That's a great question. Suitably crunchy, yeah. Interestingly, my experience is that most people within a team are up for it, actually. I've been very surprised. I think sometimes I start out with a team and think, oh, how far can I push it? and I'm surprised that the majority of team members are fine to explore themselves and their own part in it. And you're right, there are, I think it's most difficult where, say, you've got 7 or 8 people within a team who are perfectly willing and have some degree of skill already at looking at themselves and their own patterns and behavior and are really up for learning, and maybe 1 or 2 who aren't. That's the most difficult, because it would be, it's very, or a trap is for those 2 people, for example, then to become ostracized and sort of seen as the problem. Whereas actually it is a manifestation of the team. So this is what the team is like. You are very different. So there's a fundamental point about respecting difference and not forcing anyone to do something or to do a process. And I've heard horror stories in the past of people being forced to do psychometrics against their will and forced to share them with team members. And that just destroys trust. It makes the issue more difficult. The way I typically deal with it is I'll go full steam ahead with those who are up for it. And I will try and come alongside those who are not up for it and try and understand what their need is and what their reluctance is. And not to make any assumptions about that. And it may be anxiety, it may be fear, it may be a whole different issue that they're dealing with outside of work. There might be, you know, some people saying, I'm just not going to go there. There might also be a misconception about what individual work is. I'm a big fan of using a sort of an appreciative framework for some of the initial inquiry conversations, so that, you know, we're not coming in to solve a load of problems. We're coming in here to help you be at your best. And the assumption is you're already really good people doing a really good job. So if we start from that starting point, somehow it becomes a bit less frightening. But I personally believe there's no substitute for coming alongside individuals and providing a confidential space where they can say, well, this is what's going on for me, and not forcing anyone to do some individual work that they don't want to do. I don't think that's ethically responsible from the point of view of a consultant or a trainer or a facilitator.
Okay. For me, in kind of navigating these crunchier questions, I think I tend to sort of fall back on what my underlying orientation is in terms of sort of philosophy. And I talked on the first episode about being a dialogic practitioner and also with a view to systemic understanding. And so what you said there in terms of, rather than looking to the individual to understand the problem, it's actually looking through to say, this is actually just a symptom within the team, and sort of Barry Ostry's work around what do we learn about the quality of the water that the fishbowl, that the fish, you know, is drinking, rather than is it the fish that's sick? And so I think there's something that reorientates us that, again, I'm not sure, and maybe you've got a different experience of this, but I'm not sure how often clients step into asking, what's your underpinning foundation to how you believe organizations and individuals relate? Because actually it hugely informs what our role is, what interventions we might recommend. You know, so from the dialogic perspective, it's kind of at the other end of the diagnosing, because that's comparing to something out with. The dialogic is unfolding what already is there, but it's trying to get this stuff out the way for that team itself. What's your sort of underpinning foundation, if I can ask?
It's interesting, coming back to something you just said about whether clients ever ask this. They very rarely ask it, actually, yeah, in terms of what's the sort of underlying philosophy. And I'm not sure how articulate I can be around that. There are certain underlying principles that I would hold on to. So one is I think something I've already mentioned about my view of social construction, so that individuals are different versions of themselves in a team, and the team is made up of those individuals. So it's this interconnectedness. Mm. Yeah. So we cannot separate out the team from the people within it. So there's something about interconnectedness. There's something around everyday human interaction. So the team, in a sense, might have all sorts of objects that symbolize it. It might have a room or a logo or whatever, but it only actually comes into being in the everyday interactions of those people. Mm. And its relationships with other parts of the organization or customers or suppliers or wider society. So the work of the team is in the everyday micro interactions between those members. So that's another principle, it isn't out there. It's right here and now, and we're doing it now. And that's both a huge responsibility, but it's also hugely liberating, because it means you can change things actually very simply by paying attention to what's going on here and now. Mm. And where individual, I suppose another principle is individual responsibility. Everybody who is a member of a team has both the right, the responsibility, and the good news, the power to do something about it. Mm. To progress or to change things or to transform or shift. It isn't the responsibility of the facilitator or the team leader or the HR person, who are the three most common people it gets projected onto.
Yeah,
this responsibility. So, socially constructed world, systemic is sort of a word you use, but everything is interconnected, and the team exists in the everyday micro interactions of the people. It doesn't actually exist beyond that, in a way.
The just sort of tying it back to what we had, what we were talking about in terms of when we focus on the individual or when we focus on the team. I think one of the reflections in my experience is to be really clear that while there's a huge smorgasbord of what this work might be, what it's not is performance managing individuals. And if that's the sort of hidden sort of purpose to use the team to focus on one person, then that's a very clear boundary that's not the space. It's about, as you said, it's starting from the appreciative of, you know, enfolding or releasing, but it's not about kind of trying to fix something with one or two individuals within a team. And it's
the point at which, sorry, I'm interrupting, but I think it's the point at which an external, you say no thank you and walk away.
Absolutely.
You're right. You cannot performance manage a difficult individual through doing a team session.
No, and it's unethical on so many people's behalfs, but particularly the person involved to try and do that. But I think it's again, it's one of those things you mentioned earlier, you know, in terms of the roles that you have, being able to perhaps offer a perspective or ask a question that's a bit more challenging because you're not in the team. And when I think about, you know, external facilitators to internal facilitators, it does get cloudy in terms of does it feel safe enough? What level of risk can I take? And particularly if there's some, you know, individual dynamics within that team and you're part of the wider organization, it's a different level of contracting if you're an internal facilitator than, you know, you say, well, we could walk away, we could, and we've got clear boundaries. I'm not sure it's so clear if you're an internal facilitator to an organization's team.
I think it's, in a way, I think the role for an internal facilitator is much tougher. For all of the reasons you've mentioned, they're part of the organization, so they have history. If they've been in the organization a long time, they may have had other roles, and members of the team may know them as other people. So they've, in a sense, had to kind of reinvent themselves internally, which is not an easy thing to do. There's history, there's projections onto them. I think power and status is another issue. So if an internal facilitator within the hierarchy is not as senior as the team in which they're working, or certainly the boss of the team in which they're working, they need to have, well, it just adds another level of pressure on them in a sense. And it's not that you can't do that, but the sense of personal authority that an internal facilitator needs to have to work effectively and to challenge when in the hierarchy they are not as senior, it's a really significant challenge. And I've worked alongside internals who are fantastic at doing that, and I've worked along some who really struggle. And it often comes down to this a sense of personal authority. That is, I'm here to fulfill a role, to do a task. I'm aware of my own, if you like, my own power bases. I'm self-aware of how I, what I need. I'm quite polished and practiced and skilled at how I come across. And I've learned the skills of challenging and the skills of supporting. And I've got credibility with a group of people. But there are different challenges to being external. But certainly from that point of view, it's much easier, I think.
So can I ask, when your work has moved more virtual in this last period, what's been the impact of doing teamwork virtually? And, you know, let's get real somewhat. What do you think can shift or can't shift, or perhaps we're still learning to adapt? And again, I've got in my head Catherine Green as the HRD, you know, role, sort of saying, I think as practitioners, you need to get more flexible in how you do what you do. And you know, so it's no longer pitch up at hotel for 2 days every couple of months. And I think, you know, there is real credibility to that challenge of what is the future of this work in relation to how we should do it?
It's I mean, for all of the challenges of the last year, it has been the most wonderful learning opportunity for all of us in this profession. And I think it's fair to say I've been doing things over the last couple of weeks that a year ago I would have said were impossible to do with the team. So I see it as a classic that there's big challenges and there's real opportunities. So I think the days of the go along to a hotel and spend 2 or 3 days there together, I hope they're not dead, but I feel they will be far less frequent. And I think that's probably a good thing. I mean, to be honest, I used to spend too much of my time flying around the world, which is not good for me or the environment. And it's not just me, teams coming in from all around the world. And I think we have learned to have pretty good conversations virtually. So I'm aware, in terms of connecting with individual team members, for example, for inquiry conversations or coaching that I might be doing alongside, I actually find it much easier to do it virtually than I used to find it face-to-face. It's easier to schedule, there's less distraction. And my personal experience is there's an intimacy and a trust that one can build up with just one other person online, which I think is actually more challenging face-to-face, bizarrely. And that surprises me, but that has been my experience over the last year, providing it's set up and there's confidentiality rules are clear and it's clear whether I'm recording or not or whatever I might be doing. I think there are challenges about bringing whole teams together virtually. There's something for me about equity. So I think technology has the power to reduce power differential in teams, but it also has the power to increase it. Interestingly, a few months ago, I was working with a team and one of the issues was it was regionally centered around a particular center in Europe. And there were satellite centers on the margins of Europe and they felt isolated in the team. And that was one of the themes we needed to talk about. We came on a conference call or a virtual platform, and lo and behold, the people who are on the margins of Europe also had the worst internet on that particular day. It just happened. And it was a perfect moment of a living embodiment of the issue, is that we couldn't hear what they were saying. And actually we used it. We sort of laughed a bit about it and said, but actually this is how it feels to be them. So there is data in the way we connect with each other virtually. Some of the other advantages I see, I think it's easier to organize, to get people together without the travel and the cost and I find myself doing more 2-hour sessions with a team or a 3-hour session with a team, because it's less time. It's just easier to integrate into everybody's diaries, including mine. So I'm more flexible. One of the current challenges, and I haven't got an answer to this, is I had a view that either everyone is face-to-face or everybody is virtual. So that this idea of equity, and I've had requests now, and I've talked to some colleagues who've done this sort of work, where half the team is physically present and then the other half is virtual. And how you negotiate that as a facilitator and where you locate yourself. Do you locate yourself physically with the half team who are there, or do you also operate virtually? Or I think my preferred solution, you work with another, you have at least two facilitators and you are able to pay attention to both. And what I'm realizing is I think some of those principles which I assumed were truths are being challenged. And actually I feel as consultants, we have to find ways of making it happen. A colleague of mine was just describing the sheer joy of the half the team that were physically together at being physically together after a whole year of being apart. And then feeling bad for those who weren't there. But actually, that is how it is. And that is going to be increasingly the case. And we have to, I think Catherine's right, we have to be more flexible and we have to find innovative and creative ways of doing that while still holding the boundaries that are important.
I think we certainly, so there's something about how do we mirror the chosen working arrangements of a particular team? Because as you say, you know, this is rooted in business as usual. This isn't exceptional work that we do, you know, with teams. It has to be real work that they have to do. And if their lived environment is some remote, some in person, then I think we do need to find a way to honour that whilst also being really clear what is the opportunity cost by not being physically in a space where, so the bit that I haven't yet figured out when we're talking about teams rather than groups is there is a dynamic that's happening that involves power, that involves, you know, vulnerability and relationships. And you'll know this, that, you know, it can be a sideways glance that can be the difference between we're really moving here and we've just been cut off. And I think there's something about translating those moments that matter on the screen, not just for can we make sense of it, did we notice it, but how do they happen and how do you share that with the... So for me, there's something about honouring the dynamic of being human beings, live human beings who interact in that way, that we're not... I certainly haven't come across anyone that's found the replication of that. So I think, you know, that comes back to, you know, there's lots of this that we can do well, if not better, virtually, but there's aspects that are really quite important for these reasons that we're in the room sensing, breathing, living, you know, seeing each other together.
I couldn't agree more. I don't know whether... I'm wondering, it'll be interesting to see where technology leads us in terms of what is possible around the, you know, noticing the sideways glance and the meaning it makes. I was actually...
And how do you even do that on the screen, though? It's sort of like it doesn't make sense. I'm just looking at the picture over there. I'm not sideways glancing at anyone.
Yeah. Well, I was having a conversation only yesterday with someone who was talking about the possibility of virtual reality headsets linking to an application like Zoom within a surprisingly short space of time, where actually that then becomes the world. We're all wearing our headsets and engaging in a much more... in a way it's natural, in a way it's very artificial, but actually being able to I guess sense more what's going on. The other thing for me that I agree with you is really more challenging in the virtual space is spontaneity. One thing I've learned as a facilitator is that the need to at least do more upfront planning if you're going to do a virtual session than a face-to-face. Even if we don't stick to it, the act of planning is really, really important. And the ability to, in a sense, just be spontaneous, or for, in a coffee break, a couple of members of the team just to connect on something or to clarify a bit of feedback, or at the end of the day to go for a walk or a drink together. All of that stuff you can do, but it needs to be pre-planned in a way, virtually, which takes off... It can't be spontaneous in a way.
I think it goes back again. It was the conversation I had with Sarah where we were talking about the importance of the physical setup in relation to the potential for this work, and so we were talking about, you know, for dialogue, the importance of the circle and the absence of that table that can get in the way. And I guess I'm curious in the virtual space what enables the more transactional approach and what enables a more connected relational approach. And I think there will be things, whether it's VR or the functional MRI, you know, headpieces that we can wear, and, you know, we can learn somebody's sad or somebody's, you know, excited. But I suspect there's more that we can learn, again, as practitioners, in understanding for the nature of what we need to do, this is actually, you know, a good format for doing it, because it's largely transactional and you know, it's an agenda of stuff. Whereas actually, if it's about connectivity and that deeper collective thinking or learning, then again, we have to think what's the right format for that rather than make assumptions.
And I agree. And I think given current technology, there are things we can do. I mean, certainly paying attention to it and being aware of what is possible. And I realize I'm always encouraging team members to articulate more and be explicit more than maybe they would in face-to-face. So the need to actually articulate, this is what I'm feeling now, or this is what I'm noticing now. And finding different ways for people to do that. So it might be they voice it. It might be they write something in the chat function. It might be they draw something. So even within the current technology, I've noticed myself using multiple ways to encourage people to articulate what's going on for them.
Yeah.
In a way that wouldn't be necessary in a face-to-face environment. But actually, the discipline and the practice of that is, I think, quite a good thing to learn anyway. So I've noticed myself doing that. And just a couple of other thoughts. being present, so doing team mindfulness type exercises where they have a shared experience of something, even though they are physically apart.
Mm.
It isn't a task, it's an embodied lived experience of something. And have just sharing that in silence or a guided meditation or mindfulness session changes the quality of the interactions from that point onwards. It's something I've really, really noticed.
I've heard that from two other practitioners in this series, both of whom use nature and you know, so not as a team building in the old, you know, way of understanding that, but it is that having that shared experience and using, particularly in nature, what we see and feel before us to inform whatever the conversation is that we need to have, strategy, purpose, decisions, relationships, and how important that has, that common shared experience has been to orient the potential of that forthcoming conversation.
Lovely. Yeah, absolutely.
Just
one other thought, a very practical thing is sometimes it's really helpful to turn the cameras off. Technology's moved on dramatically in the last few years. So actually the video images are now pretty good, providing people have a decent internet. But actually some conversations are best had where there is an acute attention that can only come through listening to the voice or the spoken word, and the screen and the visual gets in the way. And so I will sometimes, we'll have a particular conversation with the team and I'll say, well, let's all just turn our cameras off now.
Yeah. I was rereading the Stanford article on Zoom fatigue yesterday and the four lessons that they were talking about. And interestingly, when they were talking about tips, twice it came up to turn the camera off. And one of them, which I again think does impact the possibility of our kind of work, is when we're sat in front of the camera, we're not as mobile. We don't make as much movement as we would in a natural environment. And again, it's that kind of load that we put on ourselves emotionally, let alone cognitively, and then physically. Whereas when the camera's turned off, people start to stand up, move about and stretch in ways that they don't when they think the cameras are on and, of course, quite close. So I think that there is something of learning and, you know, recognizing and to an extent agreeing how we're going to use the camera. So, you know, if it's one person turning a camera off, well, that's a bit of a flag. Let's inquire into that. If it's because we've talked about how we want to use the cameras and what role they play in the group, you know, they're part of the team, aren't they? Then I think it can be used, you know, in a constructive way.
So it becomes more, it's more, if you like, data to talk about with the group. It is an embodiment of...
Absolutely.
It's an example of what's of group life, isn't it?
Absolutely. So one other question. Across the various forms of your work, how do you or how do your clients judge whether the work has been, I'm going to use the word, successful? It's a lot of time. It's a huge amount of sort of investment that people give to this kind of process. How do we know that it's made a difference? What is it that we look to?
So I look to feedback from, I'm interested in feedback from everybody. So certainly the, if you like, the commissioning client. And that feedback is often not quantifiable, if I'm honest. I mean, it's often to do with the feel of the team, the mood of the team, how they feel in the team. I'm genuinely interested in feedback in terms of people's individual learning, so team members' individual learning. Success for me is often, it might be witnessing someone grow in confidence and authority within the team or take on different roles. Sometimes success is a team member leaving and getting a promotion or leaving an organization and going somewhere else and actually being far. That might be a career progression, or it might be about their personal happiness, or it might be about them really playing to their strengths. So I think for individuals, there's often there's quite a variety. Mm. I'm interested in teams, and I encourage teams to do this, to gather data about how others in the organization see them. So that might be their colleagues, the people who report to them, their clients, and ideally customers or people else external to the organization. How do they see the team? What have they noticed about? Mm. They're not privy to the internal workings, but they see the public face of the team. They also are recipients of the outputs of the team.
Mm.
So I'd be looking to get feedback from external sources as well.
Mm.
I have a kind of philosophical thing about this as well. I've kind of learned some organizations are really into trying to measure this stuff, and others just believe, as a point of principle, that it is a valuable thing to do and invest. And interestingly, I'm seeing more of the second group than the first now. I think increasingly people either agree with it or they don't. And if they do, they are not requesting as many quantitative measures as organizations used to, which I think is interesting, actually.
Mm.
Or maybe they're not talking to me anymore, those organizations. I don't know.
I find that really, it's really instructive, again, because I don't think we share very often how we or clients evaluate this work. And so it can often feel, I think, quite a bumpy conversation around the evaluation. Mm-hmm. And yet, one of the measures that I'm interested in anyway is the growth of the team in relation to, for example, their ability to notice their own patterns,
mm-hmm.
their ability mm-hmm. to kind of hold that process accountability and understand, how well are we doing, and what's the nature of this conversation that we need to bring that's different from that conversation. And it's really being able to see themselves as a collective.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, I think it's about the quality of how they integrate new team members and the quality of how team members end with them. And so in some ways, I think there are measures. Mm. They don't necessarily fall in the, will there be a number against this? Although the number of people leaving might be. But I think there are ways to say, look, it's about the development shows through in a number of ways. And part of it, consistency of language. Alignment of decision making, so there's some things in there that I think Absolutely. We have got within our arms to kind of demonstrate this is what we mean.
It's really interesting listening to you, because in a way you're being very explicit about things that maybe I sometimes hold implicitly, but I think it's really helpful. So things like consistency of decision making, with team turnover and retention, although sometimes it is in the best interest for people to move on. And that
absolutely
the point about how new team members are integrated is fascinating. I have a clear view that the maturity of a team or the development of a team is sort of indicated by their ability
absolutely
not just to say, oh, welcome to our team and this is how it is,
yeah.
but to be prepared to be changed by every person coming in and out of the team.
Which is where, if the work has been about the purpose or about the strategy, it's recognizing those aren't things, they are part of what we do. And so when someone new comes in, you should expect there to be some movement, some scrubbing again. Does it start the process to zero? No. But actually how you pick that up and do that as the team is instructive as to where you are in your own team maturity, as you say.
I'm so aware that teams with the best intent often have a big information pack for new members, and the first few months even are orientation. So talk to lots of people and we'll tell you. And I'm wondering how much listening goes on. So the sign of team development is how much are we taking time to really listen to the experiences of the person we're bringing in?
Seeing
them as a hugely valuable resource. So it's the orientation the other way around.
Absolutely. And I do remember somebody saying to me when I joined a new organization years ago, you know, you've kind of got 6 months where you're still new, and then you can't help having been normalized to that culture and that organization, or frankly, you're so not aligned that it probably doesn't last for much longer. But there's something about recognizing it doesn't last for long. What do you see and notice of us?
Yeah.
That we can learn from.
You become one of us, which was why I was so alarmed when that client said to me, "You're one of us."
You are one of us, exactly. Howard, thank you so much. I mean, I think this has been really helpful, just, you know, with the premise of, can we lift that lid a little bit more? Can we let people get a sense and, you know, take away perhaps some of the fear factor when we talk about team development, and encourage people to approach this as just an active part of how we team. So thank you for sharing some of what you do and your learnings. Just as part of an ending to this series, I've been inviting my guests to share a micro practice that they can offer our listeners that the listener can take and use with their teams. Would you be able to share a micro practice with us?
I can, and this one is deceptively simple and challenging to do in practice, but hugely powerful. So my encouragement, and anyone can do this, anyone who is a team member, you don't have to be the leader or a facilitator, is to use yourself as an instrument, as a data source. So at any point in when you are working with your team, to pause and reflect and ask yourself a few key questions. How am I right now? So how am I right now? What's going on for me? As I listen to our team conversation, what is missing? What needs to be said? And what is my responsibility to help move us on? So those are the questions. And then there's a part of that practice, which, and a real encouragement, is to be bold and to be brave. So my sense is if everyone in teams could ask themselves those questions and then be 10% braver in saying, can I just ask a question? Or can I just point out? Or actually, can I just share how I'm feeling? Because I'm really uncertain about this strategy right now, and I'm wondering how others feel. That being prepared to share, take that step, is hugely powerful in helping everybody and moving the team forward. And my encouragement is, if you are thinking it and you are feeling it, the chances are other people in the team are too. And the act of leadership, if you like, as much as facilitation, is articulating how you are and what's going on.
So it's the bravery of the individual in service of the team.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Fabulous. Thank you. What are you hopeful for as you look ahead?
We've talked about the virtual world. I'm hopeful of all sorts of new opportunities for what I would call blended teamwork. So up until recent weeks, I think I've been talking with colleagues about face-to-face or virtual, or this word hybrid. And hybrid is something which is sort of, in some ways, a compromise, like a hybrid car. It's not quite electric yet. And a colleague challenged me to think differently about that. So I have this idea of blended. What is possible in blending the best that we know of face-to-face work and the joy of all of that and the possibilities and excitement of working virtually and experimenting with what's possible? So that's what I'm excited about in the coming months and years. And also I'm excited just about what I'm going to learn about that. I can't quite imagine what it's going to look like. But if I look back, and I think it's probably true for everyone in organizations, look back and see just how much more relaxed and skilled we have become at working virtually. And what might be possible. So that blended with the possibility of spontaneity and having drinks and dinners and social time with teams as well, which is part of the job that I also love.
Yeah.
That fills me with joy and enthusiasm.
And if you are a member of a team, how can we be more helpful in our teams?
I think it's probably going back to the micro practice. Can you, through your own actions, create a culture within the team where it's okay to say it how it really is? It's okay to be honest with each other. It's okay to ask for help. So ask for help is one thing you can do when you need it. Offer help. Check in. It actually comes back to right back full circle to the outcome of the NHS research that you mentioned at the beginning of looking after yourself and looking after your colleagues and promoting honest conversation are probably the three most important things you can do.
Thank you. What I've sort of clarified over this last few years is my own mantra of being more human, more hopeful, and more helpful for and building organizations and leaders to rise into that space. And so I think it's always that quest of what does that mean? How can we be and do that? So thank you. Thank you for your time, Howard. It's been a really fascinating conversation, and it sounds such important and interesting work that you do with teams. And I thank you for just sharing a bit more of that and helping both practitioners, team leaders, HR, get a sense of what's possible, you know, particularly at a time when I really think teams need to be more effective, to be more enjoyable. And those two aims seem so important at this time.
Great. Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed talking with you, and hopefully it's been useful. So thank you very much.
Very helpful. Thank you, Howard. What a wonderful insight into this work, and I hope you find that as interesting as I did. Such a privilege to hear from such an experienced practitioner in a way that we just don't normally get access to. Each of these conversations renews my passion for work at the team level and to continue the quest to do good work to support teams become more human and more impactful. Thank you so much, Howard, for being part of that. And of course, how did you get on with the questions that you had as you listened to the episode? What is your role in this work? And what's your frame for the process that will help ensure the team owns both the focus and the priorities? I hope we've given you some food for thought as you dwell on those questions. Details of how to get in touch with Howard are on my website, which you'll find under www.debbiewaith.com, as well as a list of the references made in this episode. If you want to share your thoughts on this episode or ask me any questions, please get in touch on debbiewaith.com or LinkedIn. I'll be releasing a new Team Timetable Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.